This is day three of the 2012 Rogue River Bible School. The speaker is Brother Jim Cowie. His subject is the prophecy of Zephaniah. And the title for today's class is, He Will Famish All Gods of the Earth. Brother Jim.
Well, good morning, brethren and sisters and young people. You won't be getting an early minute today. For those of you interested, I have a full set of Bible marking notes on Zephaniah, including a synopsis, which gives you the overall view. There's far more detail in this than, of course, I can possibly hope to deal with in the course of this study. I'm going to leave a sheet on the library table at the back there. I'd like to get some idea of who might want this, because it will come in a package. There will be the Bible marking notes. There will be the videos of this particular series of studies, and there will be the movie of the raft trip, and things of that nature to fill up about 4 gigs. So if you have a thumb drive, 4 gig, there'll be enough. I also have 25 4 gig DVDs that I can burn it onto, so I just need to know how many I've got to prepare on Friday afternoon. Well, brothers and sisters, we come to have a look today at Zephaniah chapter 2. And we need to have a look at the preceding verses in verses 1 to 3, because the section we're going to be considering this morning is this section here that you can see in the green. It's the second section of the prophecy of Zephaniah, judgment on the nations. But the words that precede it, which end the first section of this prophecy, are very important. It's a preparation for what is to come. So we read in chapter 2 of Zephaniah, verse 1, "Gather yourselves together." Now that sounds like collecting people together. It's not actually the meaning of the Hebrew. The Hebrew is, as Rotherham more accurately translates it, "Collect your thoughts." Yea, collect them. In other words, get your mind working on what has already been said in chapter 1 of this prophecy, because thundering down upon you is this divine vehicle of judgment. The day of Yahweh is at hand, and 7 times in this first section of the prophecy that phrase is used. The day of Yahweh is at hand, and it's coming. It's a day of darkness and gloominess. Same language that's used by Joel in chapter 2 of his prophecy, because he prophesied of the same event. It was coming upon them. And the Chaldean locusts were about to spread across that land and to consume Yahweh's people and to carry them away into captivity. So what do you do when judgment is impending? Well, you do what we should be doing, brothers and sisters, because judgment is impending for us. The day of Yahweh is at hand. So what should we be doing? Verses 1 to 3 of Zephaniah 2 are the answer to that question. He says at the end of verse 1, "Collect your thoughts, O nation not desired." Jesenius says that should be rendered a nation without shame. A nation whose conscience had been seared with a hot iron. And they could have this confused religion with Kemarims and the priests of Aaron and not really know the difference. A nation without shame, he says. It's time you got your act together before the decree bring forth. You know, the language that is used here is very appropriate to ourselves. Rotherham translates it, "Ere yet the decree have given birth." And Paul talks about birth pangs. And there is going to be a birth. And that decree will bring forth, of course, the divine judgments that will see the establishment of the kingdom. So all of these things have a relationship to ourselves. Before the day passes, the chaff. Because, you see, Armageddon is going to be the burning up of a heap of sheaves. They shall be like stubble, says Malachi chapter 4. So the day of judgment is coming. So you can see the dual language, the dual relationship of these words to what was going to happen to them and what's about to happen to us. So it's very appropriate for us as we wait for that great day. Before the fierce anger of Yahweh come upon you. Before the day of Yahweh's anger come upon you. It's too late when it comes. So you've got to do something before. That's his message. What do you do? Verse 3. Here's the answer. Seek ye Yahweh, or ye meek of the earth, which have wrought his appointments. That's how that's rendered by another translation. Who have wrought his appointments. So this is about the remnant, the faithful remnant that will remain, who can be stirred up by this message. Seek righteousness. Seek meekness. Yes, you have to have that spirit of humility. There's no way that you can understand the implications of all of this if you've got your head in the sand and human pride blinds your vision. It may be that ye shall be hid in the day of Yahweh's anger. You might be Zephaniah's, whom Yahweh hid in the day of his wrath. Very, very appropriate, isn't it, brothers and sisters, for where we stand in the scheme of things. And this is the purpose of the prophecy, to encourage that faithful remnant who surrounded Josiah, awaiting the day of judgment. And they were going to be hid by our God in that day. So we come then to this section from verses 4 to the end of chapter 2, which deals with judgment on the nations. Now, when Nebuchadnezzar came into the land, he didn't just, of course, deal with Judah. He dealt with all of the surrounding nations. Those judgments were to be upon them all. So there's an application to the day, to that time. But you're going to see the language that is used. It's quite clear that this language is actually about the future. So we come to a Micah-like prophecy in verse 4. Because if you go to Micah chapter 1, verses 10 to 16, you'll find that there's a play on the meaning of the names that are given. So the same thing happens here, and this is the way God presents this message to people who would use their mind and think, well, hang on, I hear echoes there of the meaning of those names. So verse 4. Four, that initial word, of course, indicates that the message that has preceded is important. The day of Yahweh is at hand. Four, this is what's going to happen in that day. Gaza shall be forsaken. Now, Gaza means strong. Forsaken, Azab, means to loosen, to be desolated. So here's the strong city that's going to be desolated by these judgments. Ashkelon, a desolation. Ashkelon means a weighing place or a market. Desolation is the Hebrew word that means devastation. It's the opposite to that. Ashdod means a fortified place or a castle, and says he shall drive out Ashdod at the noonday. Noonday, yes, that's the time of the greatest activity. They're going to have to be stopped in the middle of their activity. It means a fortified place, a castle. Drive out means drive out of possession. So you see, there is a play on the meanings of these names. And verse 4 concludes, Ekron shall be rooted up. Ekron means to eradicate. The root is akar, and that's the word that is used here for rooted up, to pluck up by the roots, or to exterminate. And that's what was going to happen to the Philistine cities that are listed in verse 4. Interesting, isn't it, brothers and sisters, that that is the area today that we call the Gaza Strip, and just, of course, to the north of the Gaza Strip. It might well become a habitation for agitated Palestinians when they're thrust out of the West Bank. And that will be the only place that they have to live, and they'll be dependent on Israel, but they won't like it. They will chafe against it. And so they will be troublesome in that day. So what we have that follows is these judgments that would fall upon the surrounding nations. Now I'm going to very quickly work you down from verses 5 to 10. And we'll make the point in relation to the first and primary fulfillment of these words, but then their ultimate and secondary and most important application. You're going to see that that's plain. And that's why we've chosen the title today, which comes from verse 11, that he will famish all the gods of the earth. It's clear that the context is the future, not the past. Verse 5, he says, woe unto the inhabitants of the sea coast, the nation of the Kerethites, their name means executioners. The word of Yahweh is against you, O Canaan, of the land of the Philistines, as that should read. I will even destroy thee, that there shall be no inhabitant. So they're all going to be removed, but they're going to be replaced. We're going to see who will replace them in a moment. Verse 6, he says, and the sea coast shall be dwellings and cottages for shepherds, and folds for flocks. So you see, the inhabitants of the land of the Philistines are going to be removed. And they're going to be replaced by whom? By shepherds. And there's going to be sheepfolds. There's going to be peace. There's going to be tranquility. Who will it be? Look at the next verse, verse 7. And the coast shall be for the remnant of the house of Judah. In other words, those who survive the events of the day of Yahweh, Armageddon, the one third who are purified in the land post Armageddon, they're going to take possession of this area of the land. Today, of course, inhabited by Palestinians. Palestinians? Yes. That name came, as you know, from Philistines. That's how we got Palestine, Philistine. Got the relationship? Now, this word remnant in verse 7 is used three times in the prophecy. It occurs down in verse 9. It's the word residue in verse 9. Don't get mixed up with the word remnant that follows. It's a different Hebrew word. Residue in verse 9. And over in chapter 3 and verse 13, which is clearly about the redemption of Israel, we read this. And the remnant of Israel shall not do iniquity, nor speak lies, neither shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouth. For they shall feed and lie down. Now, I'm not sure my note of verse 13 I've just read. Yeah, the remnant. The word remnant at the beginning of that verse is that word that we meet here in verse 7 of chapter 2. So three times in the prophecy you've got this idea of a remnant. So the prophecy deals with the Philistine coast. And now he comes to the other side of the land. He comes to Moab and Ammon. Rounding off verse 7 he says, the remnant of the house of Judah, they shall feed thereupon in the houses of Ashkelon, shall they lie down in the evening. For Yahweh their God shall visit them and turn away their captivity. So it's all about the redemption of his people. Now could this apply to their return from Babylon? Well, in part perhaps, but not in terms of the language that is used. This is really latter day prophecy, brothers and sisters. And so we come to verse 8, and he deals with Moab and Ammon. I have heard the reproach of Moab and the revilings of the children of Ammon, whereby they have reproached my people and magnified themselves against their border. They did that, of course, throughout their entire history. But their day is coming, and they too will be judged, and their land vacated, because it has to be taken over by the remnant of Judah and Israel. And we read that at the end of verse 9. Let's just read verse 9. Therefore I live, saith Yahweh of armies, the God of Israel. Surely Moab shall be as Sodom. Well, that's pretty final, isn't it? As Sodom. And the children of Ammon as Gomorrah. Well, we know what those two words mean. Sodom means to scorch, to burn. And Gomorrah means a ruined heap. So these nations, in terms of where they live today, are doomed. They're going to have to be removed because this is going to become the territory. The land promised to Abraham, the territory of Abraham's spiritual and natural seed. They have to be replaced. And their remnant goes elsewhere. Goes on to say this. It'll be like the breeding of nettles and salt pits and a perpetual desolation. And the residue, here's our word, the remnant of my people shall spoil them. And the remnant of my people shall possess them. That is their destiny. And why? Verse 10. This they shall have for their pride, because they have reproached and magnified themselves against the people of Yahweh of hosts. So this series of judgments upon the Philistine coast and upon the Ammonites and the Moabites, who were indeed troublesome for the nation of Judah in these times, the times of Zephaniah, that's going to be sorted out, he says, in this era, but really God is looking down the track to the era to come, the era in which you and I live, brethren and sisters, when the day of Yahweh is coming down upon this world at a very rapid rate. Now, why can we be so confident that this is about the future? Well, because of this verse, Zephaniah 2 and verse 11. It says in the Authorized Translation, Yahweh will be terrible unto them. The word means to cause absolute fear and terror. He will be terrible unto them, for he will famish all the gods of the earth. Now you see how Rotherham puts it. He hath caused to waste away all the gods of the earth. And the Hebrew word that is used there and translated famish in the AV is a word that means to make thin, to emaciate. So what does that mean? Well, if you don't give food to people, they lose weight. Okay? Now, if you get no food, then to live, your body has to consume itself until you become like the prisoners of war in the Second World War, and you're like skin and bone. Okay? That's what God's going to do to all the other gods of the earth. So every single god that's worshipped by mankind today, and there are a myriad of them, are they not? There's all sorts of isms. There's all kinds of gods in this world that are fed by the devotees that they have, who go into their houses, into their temples, and they give. He's going to famish them all. What does that mean? They're not going to have any more devotees, brothers and sisters. There will not be one single soul upon earth who will worship Buddha or the gods of the Shintoism sect or the gods of any other religion, the gods of Babylon the Great. They're all going to be famished because they will have no devotees to carry into their temples that which sustains them today. That's the language. So is this future? Well, of course it is. And if there was any doubt about that, read the end of the verse. That men may bow down to him. The word that is used in the AV here, when it says they shall worship him, means to prostrate yourself. So they will bow down to him, everyone from his place. So right throughout the earth, all the coastlands of the nations, there will be people. Every single soul upon earth will be serving our God. Hence he will famish all the gods of the earth. So we know that this is a prophecy of the future. That is certainly not the case today. So let's change gears, shall we? Let's come now to the essence of the prophecy of Zephaniah, because we're going to go back to Nimrod, the Cush and Nimrod. You knew it couldn't be avoided, and it can't be avoided, because the next verse in our prophecy is this, verse 12. Ye Ethiopians also shall be slain by my sword. Now the Ethiopians, of course, here are the Cushites, and you are familiar with that. This is the word Cush in the Hebrew, one of three occasions it's used in the prophecy of Zephaniah. And of course the Cush referred to as the original Cush, the one in Genesis chapter 2, verses 10 to 14. A river went out of Eden, it says, and the water to water the garden. It was parted into four heads, and these rivers were named Pison, Gihon, Hiddekel, Euphrates. And the name of the second one was Gihon, the same as that which compasseth the whole land of Ethiopia, it says in Genesis 2. That's the word Cush, which just happens to mean, in Hebrew, black. And that's where the Chemerim came from, wearing their black robes. They came from the apostasy of Nimrod and Semiramis. So there's strong links here with what we've considered thus far. In our consideration of this wonderful prophecy. So all of this goes back now to Nimrod's empire. You have a look at verse 13. And he will stretch out his hand against the north. Now, if you wanted proof, brothers and sisters, that the Cush being referred to here is not the Ethiopia or Cush to the south, all you've got to do is read verse 13. He says in verse 12, ye Cushites shall be slain by my sword. Next verse. And he will stretch out his hand against the north. So we know that this is a northern Cush. Got it? The Bible interprets itself. And destroy Assyria. Further proof. Where was Assyria in relation to Israel? To the north. Okay? So the Cushites he's referring to are those who came from the work of Nimrod. And he will make Nineveh a desolation and dry like a wilderness. So here is Nimrod's kingdom. And in the Bible there are three Cushes. This is Cush number one up here. This thing will work. This is Cush number one. Then there's Cush number two. And then there was Cush number three to the south of Egypt. The Cushites in the area of Midian, of course, comes from Numbers chapter 12, where we read about Moses' wife, Zipporah. She was an Ethiopian, a Cushite. So this appears as though this was also called Cush in its time as well. And we are familiar, are we not, brothers and sisters, with the prophecy of Daniel chapter 7 and the beasts of that chapter. The first, like a lion, had eagle's wings. Now this represents the Assyrian phase of the Assyro-Babylonian Empire. These wings, of course, spoke of its warfare, its armies that spread over the whole area. But the wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made to stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Now this is a lion from the Ishtar gate in Babylon. So the Babylonian phase was slightly more humane. Slightly more. They had the heart of a man. You know, didn't the heart like the Montana Monsters yesterday, which was very... Nimrod would have been proud of them yesterday. They were hunters, you know, mighty hunters. But anyway, that's for another time. So here we've got this phase of the Assyro-Babylonian Empire when it became a little bit more humane. It was in this place, of course, that Nimrod began his kingdom. The beginning of his kingdom, we're told in Genesis 10, verse 10, was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar or Semiramis, as we said the other day. This was the place where he began to build his mega cities. And this is what he did, brothers and sisters. The four cities mentioned that we've just enumerated include a place called Erech. Now, in actual fact, that's the same as Enoch. So one of the cities he chose to re-establish was one that Cain built. When Cain was banished from the presence of Yahweh, he built a city and named it after the name of his son, Enoch. Well, when Nimrod begins his mega-cities, he rebuilds this place. It's called Erech. Slight change in the use of the language, but it's the same place. So what he did is he built this set of mega-cities, this four-square mega-city, and he built another one. In the record of Genesis chapter 10, verses 11 and 12, the margin is correct when it says, "And he went forth from Babylon, into Assyria." So his second phase of work was to go out of Babylon, into Assyria, and he built Nineveh. So the second were these cities, Nineveh, Rehoboth, Calah, and Rezin. Well, why four, do you think? Well, God responds to what he did. The earliest Babylonian kings bore the title Four Races. And when God called Abram from the very heart of that apostate system, from one of those megacities, or at least in the area of the megacities, when he called Abram and developed from him the nation of Israel, the nation was marked by four. There were four mothers for the 12 tribes. There was a four-square encampment. There were four standards. And you can go on and on. Why four? It's the biblical number for righteousness and God manifestation. And that's what had been destroyed in the earth by the work of Nimrod. So God starts again with one man, and he builds from him the nation of Israel. Now at the end of Zephaniah 2, we read of the glory of Nineveh. Have a look at verses 14 and 15. It says, "And flocks shall lie down in the midst of her, all the beasts of the nations." That's a very pregnant phrase, that one. The beasts of the nations. "Both the cormorant, the bittern, shall lodge in the upper lintels of it. Their voice shall sing in the windows. Desolation shall be in their thresholds. He shall uncover the cedar work. The lavish panelling would be stripped from the palaces of Nineveh and its sister cities. This is the rejoicing city that dwelt carelessly," he says, "that said in her heart, like Babylon the Great says in her heart, 'I sit a queen and am no widow.' They said, 'I am, and there is none beside me.' How has she become a desolation, a place for beasts to lie down in? Everyone that passeth by her shall hiss and wag his head." When they dug up the cities of ancient Assyria, they found lavish buildings. And of course, they pilfered most of that. You can go to museums in Britain and in Constantinople, Istanbul. You can go to Germany, to Berlin, and you can see a lot of this stuff that they pilfered from the palaces of the Assyrian kings. So it was there. It was a city given over to rejoicing and to pride in their achievements. And God is going to humble them. Because, you see, they were following the pattern of their father. Who was their father? Nimrod, who spat in the face of God and defied him. So that's what this prophecy is essentially about. So how did Assyria and Babylon come into Judah? Well, in several phases. Ahaz brought the design of an Assyrian altar to Jerusalem in 2 Kings chapter 16, verses 10 to 11. Remember that? The design of an Assyrian altar. That was Nimrudian. The Assyrian invasion under Sennacherib in the reign of Hezekiah, of course, becomes a type of the Gogian invasion in the prophecy of Isaiah and again in Micah. Manasseh spent almost 50 years bringing in every form of Babylonian idolatry into Judah, and astral worship included. Wherefore Yahweh brought upon them the captains of the host of the king of Assyria, which took Manasseh among the thorns and bound him with fetters and carried him to Babylon. There's a simple principle in that, brothers and sisters. What you desire, God is eventually going to give you. If you desire the world and all that it has to offer, guess what you're going to get? The world. The judgment seat. They desired Babylonian idolatry. Guess what they got? They were sent to the very home of Babylonian idolatry until they learnt to hate it. So you see, what you really desire is what you will become. It's what God will give you. So where does he go, this Manasseh, whose name means causing to forget? When Jeremiah began to prophesy in the 13th year of Josiah, you know what he said in chapter 2 of his prophecy? My people have forgotten me days without number. Who was the man responsible for that? The man called Manasseh, whose name means causing to forget. He spent the bulk of his life causing his people to forget. He destroyed every Bible, every Bible student, and every opponent. He killed them off so that the blood flowed in the streets of Jerusalem like water. He got rid of everybody who would try and undo his work. That's exactly what Babylon the Great did in its early days of apostasy, trying to get rid of all of its enemies, isn't it? So it's been consistent. So what does God do? Well, you see, Manasseh is a type, he's a forerunner of his own people who have to go to Babylon. And so God sends him to Babylon. Now that is curious, because at the time, the Assyrians and the Babylonians weren't good friends. They had a very troubled relationship. They were actually opponents at that time. So how come? How come that the Assyrians come down, but instead of taking him back to Nineveh, they take him to Babylon and lock him up in prison? Because God required it. It was a type of things to come for the nation of Judah. That's why that happened. And in the prison in Babylon, he came to hate and detest Babylonian idolatry, and he repented, and Yahweh forgave him. And I personally believe, I'm not the judge, but I personally believe from what I read in the scripture that Manasseh will be in the kingdom. Because he did repent. And Yahweh did forgive. And none of his sins, says Ezekiel 18, will be mentioned unto him at the judgment seat. None of them. But there will be millions of people who won't be there because of him. That doesn't seem fair, does it? But it tells you something about our God, brothers and sisters. He will forgive if there is genuine repentance. And I believe he's forgiven Manasseh. Now that man came home eventually. Like his people came home from Babylon, freed forever from idolatry. He was a forerunner, a type of his own people whom he had corrupted. So I want to now branch off and have a look at another aspect of this subject. It's the same theme, it's a theme taken out of Zephaniah, the last verses of Zephaniah 2, but the theme of the Assyrian. Isaiah prophesied in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz and Hezekiah. He witnessed the invasion of Sennacherib and the apostasy of both Ahaz and Manasseh. And the title of the latter-day Gogian host, of course, is used throughout Isaiah as the Assyrian. The Assyrian shall come into our land. I want to just show you a couple. I want you to come to Isaiah 10, first of all. Let's have a look at the way that the Assyrian is used. So what happened in the days of Hezekiah when the Assyrians came into the land and they plunged into Egypt? Remember? They were going into Egypt. And they came back and they surrounded Jerusalem. It was a type of things to come. Gog goes into Egypt first, right? And then is drawn back to Jerusalem. Where are they destroyed? Well, in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. Where's that? what we call the Valley of the Kidron. It's outside the walls of Jerusalem today. So Yahweh uses through Isaiah this language. Have a look at Isaiah 10 verse 5. O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger and the staff in their hand is mine indignation. I will bring thee, send him against a hypocritical nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey. Does that ring any bells? Well, of course it rings bells. That's Ezekiel 38 verse 12. Hast thou come to take a spoil? Hast thou come to take a prey? Yes, this is the Gogian invasion of the land. Just cast your eye across to verse 24 of Isaiah 10. It says this. Therefore thus saith the Lord Yahweh of armies, O my people that dwellest in Zion, be not afraid of the Assyrian. He shall smite thee with a rod, and shall lift up his staff against thee after the manner of Egypt, for yet a very little while, and the indignation shall cease, and mine anger in their destruction. And Yahweh of hosts shall stir up a scourge for him according to the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb. It's the destruction of Armageddon that he has in mind. That's why the Midianites are brought into it, because Gideon's victory over the Midianites was also typical of Armageddon. Now we could go on and on like that, but come to chapter 30 of Isaiah. Chapter 30 of Isaiah, of course, has got those words in it that are unmistakable. Have a look at verse 27. Behold, the name, the Shem of Yahweh cometh from far, burning with his anger, and the burden thereof is heavy. His lips are full of indignation. His tongue is devouring fire. This is about Armageddon. That's where Armageddon starts in this series of chapters in Isaiah. We're going to see its culmination in a moment. Well, have a look at chapter 30 and verse 31. It says this, for through the voice of Yahweh shall the Assyrian be beaten down, which smote with a rod. Have a look at the end of chapter 31, verse 8. Then shall the Assyrian fall with the sword, not of a mighty man. Where? Look at the end of verse 9. Because an ensign is raised against him. That's Christ, whose fire is in Zion, and his furnace in Jerusalem. That's where the Assyrian army of 185,000 perished, wasn't it? Outside the walls of Jerusalem. So we know that this is typical language, and we quoted, of course, Micah 5 the other day. So you can go on and on like that and find that this is the type of future events in which we are going to be intimately involved. So if Isaiah 30 begins a series of chapters that begins with Armageddon, and the language you'll see of chapter 33 verse 1 is that language, Isaiah 33 verse 1, woe to thee that spoilest and was not spoiled and deals treacherously. That's the language of Ezekiel 38, is it not? The spoiler. But careful students find this, brothers and sisters, that there's a change in Isaiah 33 when you get towards the end of the chapter. You come over to verse 17. Thine eyes shall see the king in his beauty. They shall behold the land that is very far off. That actually means a land stretching afar. This is post-Armageddon. This is when Christ has established the throne of David. He's the king. Your eyes, he says, you who have been redeemed, the remnant, your eyes will behold the king in his beauty, and you'll be standing in a land that stretches afar from the Euphrates to the Nile. That's what this is about. So what's the next work to be done? Well, the work of destroying those who oppose Christ's rule post-Armageddon. Who would that be? Babylon the Great. And just as Babylonian things survived Jericho, which is also another type of Armageddon, so Babylonian things will survive the Armageddon that we're about to be involved in. That system needs to perish over 40 years. That's why the language in Isaiah 33 shifts. It shifts to the language you find back in Genesis 10 and 11. And you don't find this in too many places in your Bible. You can check it out. You don't find it. You don't find a lot of places where the language of Genesis 10 and 11 is deliberately used in a context. Only when it's got to do with the destruction of Babylon the Great. Interesting, isn't it? But that's the way the scripture works. So we've got the king of verses 17 and 22 in this 33rd chapter of Isaiah. We've got the towers in verse 18. It says this in verse 18. Thine heart shall meditate terror. Where is the scribe? Where is the receiver? Where is he that counted the towers? Interesting language. That word occurs in Genesis 11 verse 4. They built a tower in the land of Shinar. In verse 19 we read this, "Thou shalt not see a fierce people, a people of a deeper speech." The word speech is the word safar. It's first used in the Old Testament, Genesis 11 verse 1. And it's used in Zephaniah 3 verse 9. "I will return to the peoples a pure safar," a pure lip. In other words, this is about religion. Then we read this in verse 20 of Isaiah 33. It says, towards the end, "And not one of the stakes thereof shall ever be removed." So here's Jerusalem established as the capital of the king, and not one of the stakes will ever be removed. That phrase, nasar, is the Hebrew word. It's translated journeyed in Genesis 11 verse 2. When they journeyed eastwards to establish a new system of apostasy and build a tower. So the contrast is made between what Nimrod accomplished and what Christ is about to accomplish when that system is going to be put away. And you can go on and read language like this. Let me just read this to you. In verse 21, "But the glorious Yahweh will be unto us a place of broad rivers, streams, no galley with oars, neither shall gallant ship pass thereby." I hear Revelation 18, 17 to 19. The shipmasters, you know, the ones who trade in Catholicism, they're out of business. These people who drive, you know, rogue galleys to spread the things of Babylon the Great. They're out of business, brothers and sisters. You can go on with language like that. At the end of verse 23 says this, "The lame shall take the prey." Isn't that interesting language in relation to Nimrod? "Wait for me, saith Yahweh, until the day that I rise up to the prey." And he's going to give the prey to those who today are considered lame. We're considered to be lame by the world. You poor people, you dependent people, you've got to have religion in your life. You've got to have some sort of prop. You know? The rest of the world thinks that they can do it themselves. Yesterday, day before, I was in a shop and I saw a picture of President Bill Clinton, who's about to die. He looks like an emaciated man, like one of the gods that Yahweh's going to famish. He's about to die. He used to have the top job in the world. Had the power of men. Look where he is today. And his wife's about to divorce him just before he dies. Want to swap him? They think that we're lame. We're considered lame. But the lame are about to take the prey out of the paws of Nimrod. That's what this context is about. You see, Europe today is actually rebuilding his kingdom. So when they put this poster together, Europe, many tongues, one voice, they were defying God. All right, yes, half of us speak French and half speak German, Belgian, whatever they call it, Spanish, Italian. But it doesn't matter. We can all be one. So they're building a tower. The European Union, the 12 stars of the European Union. And that's the picture they used. Peter Bruegel's painting of the Tower of Babel. And when they built their parliament building in Strasbourg on the border between Germany and France, guess what they did? They used the pattern of Peter Bruegel's Tower of Babel. So they're rebuilding the system of Nimrod, are they not? That's what they're about. In fact, they had big designs. Here is the current headquarters of the EU. This is the Berlaymont building in Brussels. You'll notice it's in the shape of a twisted cross. That's because it was underwritten by a twisted religion. You know, 1956 in March, when the six nations gathered... Six nations, I emphasise, when they gathered in Rome, their union, the EEC, was underwritten by the Pope. He was the guarantor, which is the subject of Daniel chapter 2, verses 40 to 43. Go and have a look at it. When the iron mingles itself with the clay, nations that came from the barbarian invasions, okay, they mingled themselves with the clay to form the feet of the image. They had towering ambitions. They proposed to build a tower above this building. So here's the Berlaymont down here. See the arrow? That's this little building down here. That's that one there. This tower was 1 kilometre high, 0.6 of a mile to Americans. You could see 120 kilometres, 80 miles from the top of it. Well, it never got built because, of course, they didn't have the money. But they did propose to build it, brothers and sisters. They want to rebuild Nimrod's empire. And that's what you and I are about to destroy. That's why Zephaniah is so important to us. Because it's talking about our work. It's talking about getting involved in God reversing in the earth the work of Nimrod. You ready for that? Well, we need to be ready for it because it's about to happen. Now, finishing off this morning, before I get too excited, I want you to have a look with me at what follows in the prophecy of Isaiah. We've got to be quick. We've got 10 minutes. Okay? I want to show you where this culminates. Isaiah 34, verse 1. Come near, ye nations, to hear and hearken, ye peoples. Let the earth hear and all that is therein, the world and all things that have come forth of it. For the indignation of Yahweh is upon all nations, and his fury upon all their armies. He hath utterly destroyed them. Notice the past tense here. He hath delivered them to the slaughter. Goes on to talk about that slaughter in verse 3. Now, you know, some think that this is a reference to Armageddon. It's not a reference to Armageddon, brothers and sisters. That comes in chapter 30, 31, and the first half of 33. This is a progressive context. There's no question about that. Prove it to you. Have a look at verse 4. And all the host of heaven shall be dissolved, and the heavens shall be rolled together as a scroll, and all their hosts shall fall down like a leaf from a tree. Now, when you roll together the scroll, and when you abolish the heavens, it means you have abolished every human government on earth. That's what that language means. You can check that out, Hebrews 1. You can go to other places. You'll find that that's what that language means. So this is not about Armageddon. It's about events that began with Armageddon and culminate 40 years later in the destruction of Babylon the Great. And when Christ and the saints have got rid of Nimrod's successor, the final Nimrod, who I believe will be like the first one, a Negroid, a black man, because that's what Nimrod was. He was Negroid. He came from Ham, the father of the dark races. You know what? There are black men jostling in the Roman church who they expect to become eventually, soon, elected pope. Won't that be interesting? Well, there's still two or three more popes to go. Because when Christ comes, there's another 40 years before the last one's destroyed. They've got plenty of time to get their act together. So when they do, and Christ and the saints destroy it, they've got rid of all opposing governments. The heavens, the governments of men, have been abolished. That's your context. Let's read on. Verse 5. For my sword shall be bathed in heaven. Now, Brother Walker understood this when he wrote the Ministry of the Prophets. He said, the opening of this chapter is an emphatic challenge of wide-reaching application that at once tells us that we must not limit the matter to the times of Isaiah, or a century or two later, nor to a few hundred square miles of territory that properly belonged to Edom in his day. He understood this, brothers and sisters. So let's see if we can understand it. Verse 5 says this, for my sword shall be bathed in heaven. That is, it's about government. It's about rulership of the earth. Behold, it shall come down upon Ijamir, it says in the Authorized. You should read Edom. It shall come down upon Edom and upon the people of my curse, the judgment. Now, this word curse is very interesting. It's the word kerem. It's the last word in the Old Testament, in our Bible, at least not the Hebrew Bible, but in the last word in our Bible. It's next to the word hormah in the Dictionary of Biblical Hebrew Words. It means doomed or devoted to utter destruction. It's used of Jericho. It occurs in Zechariah 14:11. There shall be no more utter destruction. The last word of the Old Testament in the Hebrew, and used in the context of the Amalekites. Saul was supposed to get rid of the Amalekites. And the word that we're considering here has this particular phrase, that's its translation, things which should have been utterly destroyed. All one Hebrew word. Its root, karam, occurs seven times in 1 Samuel 15. Utterly destroy the Amalekites, said Yahweh to Saul. So Edom here is very important, as is Bozrah. Let's read verse 6. The sword of Yahweh is filled with blood. We won't read the rest, just the last couple of lines. For Yahweh hath a sacrifice in Bozrah, and a great slaughter in the land of Edom. Now Edom, of course, means red. It's identified with Adam. The flesh in political and religious manifestation. Bozrah can signify fortification, sheepfold, or vintage. So when you look at these in the appellative sense, that is in the use of names, they denote the blood of the sheepfold or vintage. Now that's interesting, isn't it? The blood of the vintage, because the period that this is talking about is the trampling of the winepress of the wrath of God. And you see, this is why in Isaiah 63, brothers and sisters, it says, "Who is this that comes from Edom? All his garments stained with blood." I don't know why they took that hymn out of our book, but they did. All his garments stained with blood. Who's that? "Who, I tread the winepress alone," he says, "and of the peoples," he means the nations, "there is none with me." He's got his saints with him. This is the basis of Revelation 19. You want to have a look at the language of Revelation 19 and Isaiah 63. Some think that Isaiah 63 is about Christ and the saints coming from Sinai to the land and having some sort of conflict at Bozrah. No. No. It's the spiritual Bozrah that's being referred to. The spiritual Edom. Who are they? Babylon the Great. Founded by Nimrod. Now you might look at me with blank stares, but just hold your horses. And I use the term horses wisely, because in Isaiah 63 verses 12 and 13, you know how it describes Israel, who are involved in this work of trampling the winepress of the wrath of God? They're the horse of Revelation 14:20. The blood to the horse bridles, the horse is Israel, says this. When Moses brought them out of Egypt, they were like a horse in the wilderness. Yes, and they are going to be like a horse, a vehicle of warfare in the wilderness of the peoples, Europe. Isaiah 63 is an amplification of Isaiah 34. The land of Israel is to be a sheepfold for the slaughter of Gog, and thereafter Europe will become a winepress for the destruction of antitypical Edom. Now you might say, "Brother Jim, that sounds very impressive. But prove it to me." And brothers and sisters, you should say that. You should not allow someone to make statements, bold statements, that they can't prove from the Bible. I go to some places where I'm not allowed to speak about prophecy because there's so much confusion and so much wrangling over prophecy that they've put a ban on it. That's ridiculous. 80% of the Bible is prophecy, brothers and sisters. 80% of it. All of those historical records of Genesis. And you go through Joshua and Judges and Kings and Chronicles. They're all prophecy. How ridiculous are we as a community that we can't talk about prophecy? We should just have stuck with our pioneers because they got most of it right. But we haven't stuck with it as a community. And that is the greatest shame. So let me prove it to you. I want you to have a look. You can open these two chapters up. You've got Isaiah 34. You can open up Revelation 14. I'm going to read these verses here in Isaiah 34, verses 9 and 10. It says this. You know, we perhaps should pick up verse 7. "And the unicorn shall come down with them, and the bullocks with the bulls, and their land." Whose land? Well, look at the end of verse 6. "Yahweh hath a sacrifice in Bozrah and a great slaughter in the land of Edom." So it's Edom's land he's talking about. And that's the word thereof in verse 9. "And the streams thereof," the land of Edom, "shall be turned into pitch, and the dust thereof into brimstone, and the land thereof shall become burning pitch. It," the land of Edom, "shall not be quenched night nor day. The smoke thereof shall go up forever. From generation to generation it shall lie waste. None shall pass through it forever." Revelation 14 quotes this section of Isaiah 34. And if you've got the same Bible as me, you can look in your margin. Even the translators knew that. They quote this reference, Revelation 14, 10 and 11, which says this, "And he shall be tormented." Who's this about? Verse 8. "Babylon is fallen." Is fallen. Babylon the Great. He's tormented. "Fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels," the saints, "and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever. And they have no rest, night nor day." Where's that coming from? It's coming from Isaiah 34. So there is the biblical proof, brothers and sisters, that the Edom of Isaiah 34 is actually Babylon the Great. Now, why would that be the case, do you think? Why would God use the name Edom? Well, of course, that came from Esau. And who was Esau? He was the first anti-Semite. He hated Jacob with a passion. And if he could have, he would have killed him. Who is the greatest murderer of Jews in history? Don't say Hitler. And even if you do say Hitler, I'll say he had a concordat with Pope Pius XII. The Catholic Church, brothers and sisters, is the greatest murderer of Jews in human history. That's why God calls them Edom, Esau. Bozrah and Babylon and Rome are linked. They're linked by their names. Bozrah means sheepfold. Fort Babylon was in the plain of Dura, a wall, a rampart, a dwelling. Rome in Hebrew and Romith just happens to have a numerical value in Hebrew of 666. Quite accidentally means fortification. So they're linked, are they not? Bozrah was the capital of Edom, just as Babylon the Great or Rome is the capital of all nations who oppose Christ. Have a look at Isaiah 34 verse 11. But the cormorant and the bittern shall possess it, the land of Edom. The owl also and the raven, these are unclean birds, are they not? What do they represent? Well, they represent the nations. Okay? They represent the nations who are going to possess the land of Edom, namely Europe, because you see, Christ is going to have to remove it of its inhabitants who support the Pope against him for 40 years. So that land's going to be vacated, like the land of the Philistines in Zephaniah chapter 2. It's going to be vacated. Okay? Someone's going to have to live in it. Who's going to live in it? The unclean nations who have submitted to Christ. You know, the language of verse 11 of Isaiah 34 is picked up in Revelation chapter 18, verse 2. You listen to it. And he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, and hath become the habitation of demons, and the hold of every foul spirit, and the cage of every unclean and hateful bird. Where's that coming from? Well, in my Bible, in the margin of Isaiah 34 against verse 11, it says, go and have a look at Revelation 18 verse 2. That's where that's coming from. The birds and the beasts of Isaiah 34 are a symbol of the nations. In verses 11 to 15, these unclean birds and beasts represent the Gentiles. Released from Babylonian control when Rome is finally destroyed, they possess the land of Edom in verse 17. The land of Edom for the duration of the millennium. They are the them of Isaiah 35 verse 1. When you read verse 1, the wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, these nations who have submitted to Christ. Babylon and Nineveh will be empty except for the wild beasts and the unclean birds who are no longer hunted by their Nimrudian pursuers. And Isaiah 34, 15 and 17, I haven't got time to do it now, you just heard the beat go. Okay? Have a look at it yourself. What you'll find in verses 15 to 17 is the flood is revisited, every animal with its mate. Did you see that language there in verse 16? End of verse 15? Everyone with her mate. Middle of verse 16? None shall want her mate. Two by two, into the ark to be preserved. Got the language? We're going in reverse, brothers and sisters. God is unwinding the work of Nimrod. Where'd that work come from? Well, when they came out of the ark, Ham brought forth Canaan and Cush and Nimrod. We're going in reverse. That's what this prophecy is about. And the curse of Edom is lifted. In Isaiah 35, the savagery of the Assyro-Babylonian line is removed. And in verse 10 of that chapter, there is a redeemed remnant. Tomorrow, God willing, we're going to have a look at Zephaniah chapter 3.